ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
At 17, Chantelle McDougall was nannying for a 36-year-old man. At 20, she was pregnant with his child and swept up in his bizarre spiritual beliefs. At 27, they all disappeared.
I just wished I'd asked a lot more questions, no matter what.
I'm Dominique Bayens, host of Expanse, The Nan Up 4, a story of control, manipulation and isolation. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Big Ideas, the show that brings you big thinkers at the best live events on ABC Radio National. I'm Natasha Mitchell. And Brizzy listeners, ABC Radio National is going to be at the World Science Festival Brisbane later this month. And you can join me at two fantastic events on Saturday the 28th of March at 10:30 a.m. It's the Science of Sex. Bring your coffee, bring a bagel, whatever it takes. And at night, the Science Smackdown debate lands on stage. Just check out the World Science Festival Brisbane website for both of those events and how to book. Well, today on Big Ideas, a thinker whose work and whose very name has sparked controversy and cancellation, but also waves of solidarity from Bendigo to Sydney to Newcastle and Adelaide. The award-winning Palestinian-Australian writer, lawyer and academic Dr. Randa Abdel-Fattah, who was invited to speak, you might remember, at this year's Adelaide Writers' Week, a jewel in the crown of Australia's writers' festivals. Then she was uninvited, prompting the withdrawal of more than 180 other writers and speakers, the resignation of the festival's director, Jewish Australian Louise Adler, and ultimately the dramatic collapse of this year's festival. Today on Big Ideas, both women join you with a sold-out audience of more than 1,000 people at the Adelaide Town Hall as part of a community-driven alternative event organised in the wake of Adelaide Writers' Week's collapse, going by the name of Constellations, Not Writers' Week. Well known for her teen novels like Does My Head Look Big in This?, When Michael Met Mina, and her non-fiction book Coming of Age in the War on Terror. Today they're discussing Randa's latest novel, Discipline, and the surreal experience of life imitating art.
So, Randa, thank you so much for being here. I hope you don't mind if I don't use Dr. Abdel-Fattah. No, because I think we've noticed in the media a level of disrespect which has been quite extraordinary. That woman, the radioactive Randa Abdel-Fattah, and so on and so forth. So I want to have tonight the kind of conversation that I feel like I've been privileged to have and to listen to for the last 3 years about writing, about the craft of writing, about why books matter and the project of writing Discipline. So maybe we can begin by me asking you, why the title? Why Discipline?
Can I start? As a Palestinian, it's very important for me to acknowledge the Karuna people and the lands on which we're gathered today and pay my respects to elders past and present, to affirm this was and always will be Aboriginal land, and to extend my deepest love to First Nations peoples here today. Is the sound okay?
It sounds good.
The title, Discipline, was a bit of a wordplay. So part of the book is set in the institutional space of academia. So there was a bit of wordplay about disciplines in academia, about authority and legitimacy, but also the way in which processes and policies and laws are used to discipline us when we speak out.
She's so succinct. I thought, because, you know, a long time ago, before you were born, I did a master's on Michel Foucault. I thought it was a reference to discipline and punish. Am I wrong?
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, you're not wrong. No, you're not wrong, actually. Oh, we're really going to go academic?
We're really getting into it.
So absolutely, part of the book explores, well, part of the book is actually a creative inspiration from my postdoctoral research where I looked at the 9/11 generation, so people who were born around 9/11, and I went and conducted writing workshops and interviews with young people, Muslim and non-Muslim, across Sydney schools, and I asked them, what does it feel like to grow up only ever knowing a world at war on terror, that generation? And a lot of what I was noticing, particularly among Muslim students, young Muslim students, was internalizing state power. And that is goes back to Foucault's concept of governmentality. You cannot constantly control people through top-down power. Eventually, what you need to do is have them internalize power so that they start to regulate and monitor and tame and police their own actions, their own language. And this is what a lot of young Muslims were telling me, that they mute and suppress and self-censor their politics in school for fear of being mischaracterized and misrepresented. And so part of the book explores the way one character does that in the institutional space of academia and in the media, the way that sometimes the only way that you can survive the racism, the discipline of your voice and your politics is to self-censor, manage your language. And in the end, what you're doing is you are participating in your own oppression.
So I have 3,000 questions, so if you're going to applaud at the end of every response, we're going to be here till midnight. I don't mind. I love talking to random, but, you know, some of you may be tired and want to go home at a certain point. So I'm not trying to control the audience, of course. I hope you don't. As a bit of discipline and punish, you know, here we go. You said you wrote Discipline for Your Community and No Longer Interest in the White Gaze. Did you not think about this novel being perhaps also a teachable moment for white readers?
It was more a revenge plot because once I started writing it, my life could not keep up. Well, the art couldn't keep up with my life. And one of the things that happens in these disciplinary spaces, in these places, in these institutions, which we know, you know, use policy to try and censor us and silence us and manage how we speak, those processes, what happens is that you start to internalize that. And so for me, that was what was happening.
And the importance of writing for your community to kind of turn away from, as if, is it that you felt no longer an obligation, you feel no longer an obligation to, you know, because I read this book, I think white readers, non-Palestinians would read this book and have a deep understanding, a sort of, or well, an increased understanding or awareness of the complexities of living life as a Palestinian in Australia today.
Yeah. And I forgot to answer that. I'm fasting, so the fasting brain. Okay, yeah, absolutely. So if you look at my sort of the repertoire of books that I've written, I started writing when I was 16, actually. The first book was me writing in a post-Gulf War teenage coming of age. And then I rewrote the book straight after 9/11. And that was very much about correcting the record, explaining, defending, justifying the idea that if you only knew who Muslims were, you wouldn't assume that we were terrorists. I have come a long way since then, where the white gaze, the white opinion, the white respectability politics means absolutely nothing to me. What I wanted to do with this book was to write a book that validated the experiences, the trauma, the struggles of young, racialized journalists and academics who are working and living with the weight of a genocide on their shoulders, and to give them a sense that they can be seen in these pages, and to really go through, especially Hannah's story, to show the struggle that it takes to have to show up at work and do the water cooler talk and pretend that your family isn't trying to exist under bombs in Gaza, or that you aren't a young mother trying to raise a newborn child, having to show up at work and still do the what did you do on the weekend and pretend that you didn't check your WhatsApp to see if your family members were still alive. And so for me, this gets completely erased, and the way that we live as racialized communities, and First Nations people have known this before we do, they have deaths in custody as the green screen of their lives. They have stolen generations as the green screen of their lives. It's constant in their lives, and yet you have to still show up and pretend that life goes on. And for me, it was so important to validate that. And if white readers read that and had a window into that trauma and extended solidarity, that was a bonus. And if my enemies read it and used that as an opportunity for me to show them how much contempt I have for them, especially white liberals, that was an added bonus.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the narrative, the story you've written. It starts with Nabil, a high school student who's accused of terrorism, and you have a cast of characters, three principal characters in the novel, but you started with five characters. Why did you end up reducing it to these three main characters?
So I started writing the book in 2022, and I still have the emails where I was approaching and pitching the book to publishers and saying, is there any interest in, you know, an appetite for anybody to read about the world of countering violent extremism and the world of surveillance in, you know, Muslim communities and highly racialized communities and the way that that trickles down onto young people? It just feels that this is out of the headlines. And there was a little bit of interest, and, you know, I wanted to talk about what it means to try and express your political agency as a young person when you are living a world in a world and in communities that are hyper-securitized, hyper-surveilled, where your bodies, your geographies, your language are infused with negative stereotypes, which, you know, even when I interviewed some young people, they said to me that when they hear the word Allahu Akbar, they immediately think of terrorism. Now, they weren't born that way. That is the cumulative weight of years of headlines and popular culture and policy. And so, you know, trying to get a story about that is something I wanted to do. And then October 23 happened. I was creatively paralyzed. I put it aside. And then I returned to it, as I said, when my art couldn't keep up with my life. And I thought, actually, I can't write a book that's set as my people are enduring a live stream genocide. What I'm angriest about as a Palestinian is all of this was preventable. What I am angriest about is that those tens of thousands of children, those hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who have been slaughtered on our phones, the blame for that, the accountability is on the media which manufactured consent for this genocide. It's on the journalists, like the one who refused to let me say apartheid on Q&A in 2021. It's on the journalists who dared to mute our political language, who dared to censor us, who dared to say that what we saw was not testimony or we weren't reliable witnesses. And so for me, this book, I restructured it to say, let's talk about accountability. If you had said something as an academic, as a journalist, when you had the chance in 2021, Israel's last bombardment, would we be here now where we have reports declaring what Palestinians on the ground have been declaring if you had believed brown bodies as reliable witnesses? But we need a UN body or a report to verify the witness testimony of the actual victims. And this is why I said it in May 2021, to have that distance and to hold my readers to account, to say, when you have the courage of your convictions to actually speak the truth of what you see, then that is an act that can stop the violence of silence and the violence of obfuscation.
I want to ask you, just pause a moment, just to be away from the actual narrative, about the process of finding a publisher. You end up with the wonderful Aviva Tuffield at University of Queensland Press. Yes, big clap for Aviva. But the process of finding, what were the months, what years were you actually trying to, what year were you pitching the book? And what was the response of publishers to the proposal? I wonder if they ran for the hills.
Well, it's very funny. I was in the US at a Palestine Rights Literature Festival in September 2023, and I was sitting in the hotel in New York when I emailed the pitch to a publisher here, and the response was, the first page is too political. And I thought, oh, this is not the publisher for me. And so after that, I realised I would only seek out a publisher who wanted a work that was political, and that was in the amazing, indefatigable Aviva Tuffield.
Yes. So it's interesting that you raise the question of the political novel, because this is incontrovertibly a political novel. And after the Spanish Civil War, a couple of editors put together an anthology called and Authors Take Sides. That collection, that anthology, was then reproduced or reissued after a succession of other wars, including the Vietnam War, the Iraq War, the Gulf War. And while I was at MUP, we published an Australian edition of that book. And I went around to Australian authors asking them if they would like to take part. And I remember ringing up Frank Morehouse, and the now not no longer with us, Frank Morehouse. And he said, oh, that's an interesting idea, but why aren't you doing a collection called Dentists Take Sides? And I said, well, if he'd met my dentist, he'd probably know why. But the question was an interesting question, and he was sort of balking at the idea that authors are required to take sides, or that I was asking authors if they were interested in taking sides about this particular war. In the end, of course, he gave us a contribution. It was a wonderful contribution. I wondered how you thought about the idea of writing the political novel and, you know, the difference between creating an imaginative world and the relationship with actual current events, which we have in this novel, and a kind of position that you want to articulate, how you thought about that in crafting the novel.
You can't ask a Palestinian to separate their politics from their existence. There's a beautiful poem from a Palestinian poet in Gaza who is actually addressing this question of art and politics. And he says, in order for me to write poetry that is not political, I must listen to the birds sing. And in order for me to hear the birds sing, the warplanes must be silent. And I think that is a metaphor for what it means to move in the world as a Palestinian, as a First Nations person. You cannot sit down at your computer and say, I'm going to suspend my politics and the live stream genocide of my people as I choose which adjective to place in this sentence. The craft comes from the desire to see a better world. The craft comes from the burning pain and rage within us. And that is the beauty and the struggle of writing these stories. For me, it's not a question of having to separate the politics from the art. All art is political. And it drives me crazy when the white Western liberal subject assumes that they are objective and neutral. There's an excellent quote by a Colombian professor, Santiago Castro Gomez, who says the Western myth of point zero means the Western myth of a point of view that sees itself as beyond a point of view. It is a false statement to think that anything is neutral or objective. It is 100% rooted in some kind of ideology. And the most obvious, when I hear journalists say, be balanced, be neutral in genocide, is how can you be neutral over genocide? To say that you are neutral or objective over the slaughter of other human beings is in and of itself a position, is in and of itself taking a side. And there are many journalists, there are many artists who are happy to wear their politics on their sleeves. And I'm unapologetic about the fact that the elephant in the room here is the Palestinian is not considered a human being. The essence of all of this is the racism and the dehumanization. Because you can be political about anything. And those who are loudest in silencing about our politics are very happy to be political on many other subjects. But the red line for them is the Palestinian as the human.
On ABC Radio National, ABC Listen, and wherever you get your podcasts, this is Big Ideas with the Palestinian-Australian writer and academic, Dr. Randa Abdel Fattah. She's speaking at this Constellations Not Writers Week event at the Adelaide Town Hall. Hello, I'm Natasha Mitchell, and Randa is joined in conversation by former Adelaide Writers Week director Louise Adler to talk about Randa's latest novel, Discipline, and her experience as a Palestinian Australian.
So let's talk about some of the characters in the novel. Let's talk, you mentioned Hannah. She's the only Muslim journalist in her workplace, and she shows us how people of colour survive or don't in the modern mainstream media newsroom. She's subjected to open and tacit racism. She's exploited for her community connections, and yet her individual experience is ignored. We have, you know, actual evidence of this, don't we?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when my young Arab journalist friends call me and say, I'm about to read Discipline, I say to them, it's going to be triggering for you because you're going to see those stories, that gaslighting, the management of your voices, the transactional way that you are used and exploited to get closer to communities, and then your stories are managed in a way that always, always is about the white gaze or about certain racist tropes. So for me, Hannah is Palestinian. She's married to a Palestinian man from Gaza, and she's a new young mum. She's a young journalist, and I really wanted to show the struggle of trying to bring every version of yourself to work and having to mute and suppress aspects of yourself. Because the thing is, we know that all these institutions, they just love extracting diversity from us. They love our food, they love our culture, they love our music. They absolutely love the whole diversity, equity, inclusion, so long as you behave. So long as you leave your politics at the door, your grief, your anger, your rage, so long as you're not a difficult woman at work or a difficult man at work. And she problematizes that space because she is in a time of grief. Her in-laws are in Gaza. Every morning they wake up, are they alive? And there is a gross insensitivity to what it means to move through these workplaces as a Palestinian in the last 2 years. And I will say that even amongst allies in the workplaces, people do not realize what it means for us every single day to wake up. I likened it, it came to me when I was watching Avatar with my kids on the holidays, and we went to one where you wore the 3D glasses. And it occurred to me, because my brain never switches off about these things as I was sitting there pretending to enjoy the movie with my kids, is that these 3D glasses, when it got too much, I put it down. But as Palestinians, we are literally, I am not exaggerating, moving every single second of our day as if we're wearing 3D glasses, and we are seeing the genocide as we are talking to you, pretending that the world is in a 2D space. But every moment we are experiencing in a visceral way. What's the first thing you do when you wake up, Louise? The first thing I do, the first thing I know every Palestinian I know does, is reach for their phone and check if their friends or family are alive. And that is what Hannah brings to her workplace. So if I can give people a glimpse into that is what politics is, the embodied experience of living through your people's genocide.
One of the other sites of the novel is the university, and I can't help but have enjoyed that section very well. Comprehensively, your rendition, I think, is pitch perfect. These institutions that invoke freedom of speech rhetoric while simultaneously prohibiting some speech and allowing other speeches. I suppose when I think of universities, I'm reminded of the definition of the Oxford Senate, a hotbed of cold feet. But I wondered how your own experience at Macquarie University informed the characters of Ashraf and Jamal.
Do you want to get me fired again?
Do I want to get you fired?
No, not suspended. At all. No,
they can't fire you now. No. It's all over. You've won. Have won.
Before we talk about the university space, can I talk about Adelaide quickly? Because I think this is very much a metaphor for what we're talking about here, about the whole use of diversity. I remember when I went to read the statement about my cancellation, I had to first go through an acknowledgement of country on the website. And I think that juxtaposition of performativity and then racism captures every single institution in this white supremacist country. And this is what it's like in university spaces. The statements of solidarity that you send to colleagues who have CVs with pages and pages of articles written about settler colonialism and racism, and they don't even respond to your statement of solidarity, or they outright refuse to sign it. Those who have built careers off the backs of community, studying them, researching them, exploiting them, extracting from them, writing about them, but never ever live those values. It's just performance, it's just words, it's just filling up the CV. And the thing is, I could have written about that in a way that was solemn and somber, but instead I had fun. Because you can only ridicule these people because they are caricatures of themselves. And one thing that proves that is that so many of my academic friends said, "Were you talking about my boss? Were you?" And I'm like, no, this is the one time when I didn't need to write a 3D dimensional character, because they are really just such stereotypes of themselves. The material was just there in every institution. You always have the, you know, the one who pretends to be on your side and the ally, but will never ever speak up against management, who will always maintain and protect the status quo, or those who, you know, within diversity, equity, inclusion committees, and for the most part, they're all white people on those committees. you know, so the ironies and the contradictions, they deserve to be ridiculed because they are embarrassing.
My friends in universities don't like it, but I always remember a new, you know, liberal sitcom and The West Wing and President Jed Bartlett saying that politics is a dog eat dog world. In the academy, it's the other way around. Takes a while for people. So Ashraf is a secular liberal scholar. He's trying to survive in the academy. You call him the model minority. But interestingly, you don't demonize him. Is he an opportunist or is that too harsh?
Yeah, so Ashraf is a character in the book. He's Egyptian background. He's very much internalized a lot of Islamophobia. He represents a certain generation. I've got a lot of uncles like this who, you know, it's an existential crisis for them. The idea that if you're approximate to whiteness, if you perform as the model minority, if you work hard, you can rise, you know, the corporate ladder or the university ladder, and then you can bring people up with you. It's a very much a mindset of gratitude. Don't rock the boat, because there's a sense that if you do, they'll, you know, you'll be threatened. There's never any courage there to change the system, to challenge the system, because there is a sense of understanding your position within it. And I think it also represents a very much an existential dilemma for many racialized minorities who are so enamored by the white liberal promises and believe in it. The idea that settler colonial recognition is going to make me successful, because think about it, when they actually confront the fact that this is a white supremacist system and that you are only as good as your silence, that represents a really major dilemma for people who have, you know, come as refugees or come for a better life here, to realize actually at the end of the day, when push comes to shove, if I dissent, if I speak up, I will be crushed. And we have seen that play out since the genocide in Gaza, that we have seen the way that minority communities who have spoken up have been crushed. We've seen students, for goodness sakes, at encampments, you know, brutalized, imprisoned, their university degrees threatened, because they've chosen to stand up and because they've refused the lies that the state has told them. And so for Ashraf, for me, I didn't want to demonize him, because I do believe that there are people who have grown up thinking, particularly post 9/11, that if we only behave, then they'll let us be, they'll let us succeed. And my research and my lived experiences tells me that, like misogyny, white supremacy will brook no dissent. And so if you are the difficult woman, misogyny will come down hard. If you are going to challenge the white supremacist system, you will be crushed.
So I was thinking about 9/11, and you said that you were radicalised post 9/11. And I thought, I was trying to figure out your age, and, you know, I was going to ask you, well, why were you not radicalised before? And I thought, well, maybe Randa was about 11, and maybe that's an unfair question. But I think we agreed you were a little older than 11. So why weren't you radicalised before, in thinking about your own history and your own personal formation?
So I don't know where after 9/11, it wasn't after 9/11 that I was radicalised in terms of my racial literacy. That came after my PhD. After 9/11, my politics was actually quite shameful. Reflecting on it now, I understand now what it represented at that time. You know, we were in the early 2000s. I was a university student. I had just finished university when the 9/11 occurred. And we were in a time of complete fear that, you know, there was a collective sense of defense, of guilt by association. And we genuinely believed that the reason that we were being attacked and vilified, I mean, my mum was the principal at an Islamic school. We had pig's head thrown in the office window, arson attacks. We, you know, a litany of case after case after case of abuse and racism. And the idea then of a very young Muslim community was, we need to just explain that Islam does not condone terrorism. And if only people understood our faith, then they would understand that these associations and misrepresentations are false. It was very naive not to understand the political economy in which terrorism operates, the military-industrial complex, and that these states have no interest in who we are as individuals. So I lacked the kind of racial understanding then. It was only after I did my PhD looking at Islamophobia in Australia from the point of view of the perpetrators. So I started to interview people in 2015, 2014 who were openly Islamophobic, who had just started some of the more far-right parties and trying to understand their Islamophobia. And that's the point at which I realised I have been misunderstanding who I am on this colony all these years. I am a settler. I cannot understand Islamophobia here unless I understand that this state was built on stolen land and that my understanding of race here must be tied to understanding, as Aileen Wharton Robinson says, First Nations distinguished professor, that we have the unfinished business of Indigenous sovereignty and everything else stems from that. And that's when I was radicalised. That's when I understood I don't care about multicultural liberal promises. I care about my position here as a settler of colour and my solidarity with First Nations people, and that's where liberation, collective liberation lies.
Reflecting on her experiences as a Palestinian Australian in 21st century Australia, Dr. Randa Abdel-Fattah, academic author and something of a lightning rod in the battle over freedom of speech since the Israel-Gaza war, a theme she explores in her latest novel, Discipline. And you're listening to her on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas and ABC Listen with me, Natasha Mitchell. In conversation with Randa is former Adelaide Writers Week director and prominent Jewish Australian Louise Adler. And they're joining a sold-out Constellations Not Writers Week audience at the Adelaide Town Hall.
So acres of column inches have been devoted to a couple of your social media comments, and I wanted to ask you about a couple of them specifically. The idea of cultural safety, I've listened to you explain it, and I wondered whether you would explain it for this audience. What you mean by cultural safety, I think that it's been taken by Zionists to imply that their physical safety is imperiled. And, you know, in spaces that Palestinians might speak, or that's what's at risk. And so I wondered if you could tease out for us what the notion of cultural safety actually means.
Yeah, well, in your opening remarks, Louise, you spoke about the importance of context and how mainstream media is almost programmed to decontextualize everything that we say and do. And so the context of my intervention on social media, in which I said that Zionists do not have the right to cultural safety, is really key to understand. It was in the context of the State Library of Victoria cancelling a series of online writing workshops with writers and poets of colour, and they cited as the reason the cultural safety of the children who were going to participate. So basically implying that the workshops to be run by these Arab and writers of colour and diverse writers would put these children at risk, that they were culturally unsafe for them. And then at Wamalaid Festival, there was an electronic dance company, I think 47, it's not my genre of music, but a Palestinian electronic dance group who were also cancelled. And this reason was cited again, cultural safety. On top of that, we were seeing at the time, this is March 2024, that's very important for me to foreground this, and because it continues until today, the privileging of one group's sensitivities and feelings and emotions over the facts of a genocide. We are living in a world in which what we are being told is to deny the evidence of what we can see and defer to the feelings of those who support and sympathise with our genocide. Hanan Ashrawi, after the Oslo Accords, said that they have made the occupied responsible for the security of their occupiers. And I liken it to they have made the victims of a genocide responsible for the feelings of those who support their genocide. And I refuse that. I refuse it because there's a difference between facts and feelings. And there was a Palestinian in a refugee camp in Haifa in 1948 who said a line that has stuck with me in her memoir. She was repeatedly told by Western powers that she had voluntarily migrated to Lebanon in a refugee camp in 1948, and she was part of the Nakba. And she said, "Zionist deeds are more eloquent than Zionist words." Likewise, African-American novelist James Baldwin said, "I don't believe what you say because I can see what you do." And this is the crux of the matter. We are constantly asked to defer to the feelings of people while we see the dismembered bodies of Palestinian babies on our screens. And that is the essence of the racism that we are confronting. And that is why I intervened to say that if you are a Zionist, a political ideology, there's no such thing as Zionist DNA, Zionist food. You're not born a Zionist. It is a political ideology. And like all political ideologies, communism, settler colonialism, liberalism, it should be subject to the same normative interrogation as any ideology. And as a person who works in the academic space, the art space, if a student were to stand up in class and start to speak in defense of white supremacy, in defense of segregation, racial segregation, or if a misogynist stood up and said men are superior to women, if a settler colonialist sympathizer were to stand up and say, "I have the right to steal this group's land and to build my state on top of it," we would shut that down. We would shut that down. And yet we are being asked to exceptionalize the ideology of Zionism. And so no, racialized communities, racialized peoples have the right to cultural safety. It's actually a concept that comes from Maori nursing educators that actually comes out of the experiences of violence and colonization, which says that racialized communities and people have the right to cultural safety, not ideologies. And that's the distinction. Jews have the right to cultural safety. Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, ideologies don't. They should be subject to interrogation and critiqued. And that is the fundamental difference, that the people who are attacking me want to protect an ideology that argues for the dispossession of my people's land, that argues for settler colonialism, that argues for genocide, to be exempt from criticism. Where is my cultural safety as a Palestinian? If you rob me of my right to use my political language to analyze what is happening to my people, where is my cultural safety? How am I supposed to talk about my liberation and my people's freedom if you are taking the very words from my mouth? What is left for me then? And that is, again, the heart of the question here, that who we are as Palestinians is so deeply dehumanized that that did not ever come up. That those who claim the right to cultural safety have never given me my right to cultural safety as a Palestinian.
So that explanation, that teasing out of what you had in mind when you used the term, you know, it's a nuanced, sophisticated, comprehensive arguing of a position. The tweets that you've crafted have been taken, you know, as they are undifferentiated, they're not your tweets, but the reception of them, or some would say that the tweets are not nuanced or not subtle enough or not sophisticated or not contextualized enough. So how do you balance, you know, you're thinking about your use of social media, how do you think about that, given the explanation you've just given us, which, you know, seems to me to be completely cogent, and I happen to agree with it, but that's not the point. But why bother with social media, for example, if all that the response you get on social media is to trivialise, demonise, and vilify, and, you know, contort, distort what you've had to say or what you're thinking about?
It's an excellent question, because I've really been reflecting on this given the controversy and mischaracterization of my tweets, and actually the way that the lobby almost conducts an audit of what I've said online and picks and chooses and cherry picks for a political campaign and agenda. And when I go back to the tweets that have raised, you know, the ones that have been recycled the most in Senate hearings and Murdoch Press and even by, you know, politicians on all sides, one thing that I realize is that as a Palestinian, you don't have the right to an emotion, to rage, to anger. You don't have that right. Every time you say something in public, you must add an academic reference. You must add something to legitimise and provide an alibi to your political agency, because your victim impact statement is never enough. So if I had provided some citations to a tweet, maybe I would have been protected. But I think about it now, because it's like what I said to you before about the 3D glasses. People just don't understand the level of ongoing trauma every single day is. Some of those tweets, conveniently, people ignore the fact that I quote tweeted, which means I was I shared material underneath it. That was the context. One of them was the attack on a hospital in which a journalist was standing outside with four other journalists waiting for his wife who was giving birth, and he was killed in a bomb. The other one was the babies on New Year's Day, I think, or New Year's Eve 2025, who were frozen to death because of the blockade. And so very often, you know, we are watching horror upon horror upon horror, and there were times the only, like you said, the only available space we have is social media. I would have loved to write an opinion piece about cultural safety, but every single opinion piece I've ever sent to The Age or the Sydney Morning Herald or to The Guardian gets knocked back. And so instead of a nice long essay, I get 140 characters, and that is what we are left with. And I understand now the space we are in is so malicious and vexatious and dangerous, given the way that lawfare is now being used against us, that we don't even have the luxury to express our rage or anger, despite the horror that we are witnessing.
So just thinking about the catalogue of instances in the last couple of years where universities, arts organisations, media organisations have been under attack while we're live streaming, while we're witnessing a live stream genocide in Gaza. And I think you've said that you think that these have been the greatest source of repression and gaslighting. Do you think, taking a broader view of it, that this is the latest iteration for, you know, the lobby, the Murdoch press, however we want to describe the forces arraigned against the kind of discussion you're hoping to have, that this is the latest iteration of the culture wars? When I look at, you know, the Gillian Siegel report card that Greg Craven's to have on universities, for example, or, you know, the late, you know, what happened at Bendigo or to Khalid Sabsabi or however many other instances, or, you know, here in Adelaide and the Premier's actions. Do you think it's a refreshed, revised form of the culture wars? Or maybe it's never ended, maybe we're just perpetual, you know, sort of, we've had a long time of this. But do you think that's what's going on?
I think it borrows from the culture wars. It uses the culture wars to legitimise the work that it's doing. But I think that the objective and the agenda is to shield Israel from critique. And I think that it can package it in some coverage as culture wars, particularly around the arts. And we have seen that, you know, all the woke leftists criticising conservative voices, and because that will appeal to a certain demographic. I mean, I see racists very much as lazy, and they will use a smorgasbord and they'll take whatever they can, you know, consume from it that's going to work. And so in some articles, it's very much couched as the culture wars, and a lot of the coverage around us was about that. On the other hand, I think it's important to understand this moment since October and the repression and the collusion between the state and institutions and the way that they are ingratiating themselves and appeasing, you know, Hasbara propaganda and these tactics to silence us is it's political work, and it's very much about silencing and crushing our voices about a genocide. And I think that's the reason why we're seeing this escalate and get even worse, is because they've lost. You know, this is the beast thrashing around. They've lost an entire generation. You can't tell them, no, kids aren't starving, when they're looking at their iPhones at lunchtime in the schoolyard and seeing the emaciated babies' bodies. Well, you know, we are defending ourselves, and they're setting dogs on a Down syndrome boy or shooting children in the head. The catalogue of horror is ongoing and it beggars belief even to articulate it. But young, there's a whole generation who can see that. And so because they've lost that one, we know because of the billions that are being poured into social media to silence and to control and to shadow ban, the only thing left for them is not dialogue, it's not expressing ourselves, it's not giving us any platforms, it's to crush and silence us. That coercive, you know, force of the state has come down on us. I think that's that the culture wars serve that purpose.
And it's interesting, though, at the level of language that, you know, the lexicon seems to me to be shifted. I'm not being a Pollyanna here, but 2 years ago, terms like genocide or apartheid would have been so transgressive. They would have been taboos. That's a real shift, isn't it? And we're talking about the West. We're talking about Western, well, the Western world, the West, even the Western media have crept very ever so timidly towards using that kind of language.
Yeah, because hundreds of thousands of people have been slaughtered, and even still it takes a lot of effort for some people to still use those words. But I do feel as well that it's because now it's undeniable, mm-hmm. and the weight of evidence. I mean, everything that Palestinians have been telling you for decades has been ignored. It was only when, you know, UN reports and outsiders and Westerners validated the evidence of the native that people started to maybe use that language. So there's a lot of anger and bitterness from us as Palestinians about that as well, because our actual lived experience has never been enough. You know, how many interviews we did before October 2023 where we would fight with journalists about using the language of what we could see, you know, occupation, illegal occupation, settler colonialism, apartheid, racism. And all of it was always a struggle. You know, we would send an article back in the day where I had some hope of an article, and it would just be, can you change this word? Can you change that word? It was a constant back and forth. You were never considered reliable. You always needed an alibi. But I think, yeah, there's been a shift now because it is undeniable.
Mm. It's incontrovertible.
At what cost? You know, as Palestinians, we say, the price that we have paid for the world to see what we have been saying for over 78 years.
So, last question. Your novel raises many issues, including gender. Hannah, who's juggling work and being a new mother. And I've been thinking of you during these few months, many months really, of how you've survived the constant vilification. I remember calling you while you were writing your latest piece for Mondo Weiss. You were with your children during school holidays, probably watching that boring movie, and the media were relentlessly pursuing. The last question is, I wanted to know how you coped.
I cope because...
Coped.
Coped.
Past tense.
How did I cope?
Sorry, I'm being pedantic.
No, that's... I guess because every time that I felt like it was too much, you don't have time as a Palestinian to self-indulge and to, you know, lick your wounds and get into that woe is me, because you're very, very conscious of the fact that everything is compared to Gaza. And so there's that. You don't really give yourself permission to wallow in self-pity. Number two is that when you're with your kids, you're not Rhonda the activist or the academic, you're just mum. And there is a kind of, comfort in walking in the doors and them treating you exactly as they see you. And you are forced to show up as a mum and to forget the outside world. But then, as you said, it encroaches. And it's very difficult. It's very difficult to live as a racialized mother and to parent as a racialized person is difficult because you want to switch off. There's a luxury in switching off. But at the same time, I look at my children and I say to myself, they look like the kids on my phone. And the world that I am fighting for is for them. I've lived my life. The world that they deserve and all children deserve is the world that we have to fight for. Those are the sort of things I tell myself to cope. But it's not easy. I'm not going to pretend that it's easy, because at the end of the day, racism, it robs you of time. As Toni Morrison said, racism a distraction. It robs you of time. It robs you of sometimes your dreams and ambitions. But the one thing that it will never take away is community. It will never take away self-worth. And it will never take away purpose in life. And I think if you live without purpose, that's when you know that they've won. And it has never been more crystal clear to me that Gaza has clarified for so many people why we are on this earth and what we need to do to make it a better place. And I think for me that shows that we are victorious and that they won't win.
So, champion, thank you so much, Randa. Thank you for your courage, thank you for your empathy, and thank you for your humanity.
The sound of a massive crowd at the Adelaide Town Hall earlier this month to see Dr. Randa Abdel-Fattah, a former lawyer, now sociologist at Macquarie University. She's researching Islamophobia, race and the war on terror, and is author of 12 books, including her latest novel, Discipline, which recently won the People's Choice Award at the Victorian Premier's Literary Awards. And she was speaking to Louise Adler, former director of the cancelled 2026 Adelaide Writers' Week and former publisher of Melbourne University Press. And that event was organised as part of the diverse community-run Constellations Not Writers' Week Festival alongside the South Australian Friends of Palestine Association. Next on Big Ideas, we're going back to a world of heroin chic and girl power.
The slogan girl power was a Riot Girl slogan. It was initially coined by two members of the band Bikini Kill. They were working on a zine one afternoon, I think, and they were looking for two words that didn't go together. And the drummer, Toby Vell, I think, said to Kathleen Hanna, like, what's a word that doesn't go with girl? And Kathleen said, power. And so the pairing of these two words as a slogan, yes, it was about, you know, power to girls and women, but it was also about, why don't these words go together? Why do we not associate women and girls with power? Why? It was, you know, a slogan that was really intended to make people think. And then the Spice Girls came along, obviously co-opted this slogan, took it for themselves, made it hugely famous. But in doing so, it had lost all its activist intention, I think, and all of its kind of prickly energy. And it was much more celebratory in the way that post-feminism, as a reaction to third wave feminism, was much more about, like, don't worry, you can, it's not necessary, like, feminism is not necessary anymore. Women have made all this progress. You can wear whatever you want. You can sleep with whoever you want. You know, you can, you're free. Go out and spend money and have fun. And it was an intoxicating message, I think, because it was, you didn't have to do anything. Like, you didn't have to fight. You didn't have to go to meetings. You didn't have to do zines. You could just, you know, go out and buy lip gloss. And the Spice Girls had £500 million worth of branding deals in their first year and a half as a band. They had Spice Girls body spray, Spice Girls trainers, Spice Girl Polaroid cameras, like whatever you wanted to buy, you could buy a Spice Girls version of it. And once people saw how much money could be made by putting pop stars on things, it was really the end of the road, I think, for people being interested in women and their angry rock about abortions. It was much more like, oh, here's a shiny pop star and she'll sell lip gloss to teenage girls and that will make us money. And so that was really explaining, I think, what happened after.
She's a Pulitzer Prize-nominated culture writer with The Atlantic magazine, and Sophie Gilbert is also a millennial. She knows what she's talking about, and it's all in her book, Girl on Girl, How Pop Culture Turned a Generation of Women Against Themselves. You'll meet her next time here on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. Join me then. Natasha Mitchell saying bye for now. Thanks for your company.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.